Well, what is so special, or perhaps it's more polite to say, what is special about Buddhism? Now, I can't tell you what's special about Buddhism for you. I shall have to confine myself to what's special about Buddhism in my own experience. So it's a subjective evaluation. It's necessarily rather autobiographical. I hope you don't mind that. I have a feeling that any genuine talk is autobiographical anyway. So I'm going to tell you, share with you tonight, briefly, what I find particularly valuable about Buddhism. One of my jobs has been to teach comparative religion, and I had rather fun trying to characterize the big six religions. And this is again, this is a subjective evaluation, but I liked, for my own purposes and for the instruction of my students, initially, before they got into things, just to find one or two words to characterize each of the great six religions. And it did help me, and still does help me, to put Buddhism in a context of world religions. And this little table of mine runs something like this. Hinduism. Well, before I tell you about these, let me just say that the proposition is that the great religions of the world form a sort of organism, a sort of tree, an organism, a whole. And they complement one another. In my book, they are a living whole, and each has its genius, its speciality, and certainly Buddhism has its genius, its speciality, for me and doubtless for you. Well, I'll just run briefly through these six. Hinduism seems to me to celebrate, to emphasize, to enjoy, to insist upon the one, the whole, the one. For instance, in the Katha Upanishad, fill the mind, there is but one. He who divides the one wanders from death to death. Now Buddhism, an offshoot, great offshoot of Hinduism in India, it seems to me that its speciality is mindfulness, attention, or in crude American language, which I enjoy so much, telling it like it is. Telling it like it is. And that is for me, let me tell you at once, that is for me the genius, the precious thing about Buddhism. It's a religion which invites me to tell what I find, to celebrate what I notice, what I observe. It doesn't give me dogmas to believe. Of course, we can find them if we wish. We can find plenty of dogmas to believe if we wish, even in Buddhism. But I don't think we shall be chucked out of Buddhist circles. I hope not, if we don't really subscribe to anything in particular. Other than, perhaps, a few very, very basic insights or procedures, of which the principal one in my book is attention, mindfulness. Now, to go on to the others, Taoism, perhaps not such a great religion, but very, very marvelous one, partly because, of course, it contributed to Zen. The keynote and watchword of Taoism seems to me spontaneity. Spontaneity. Now, we have there the great three great Eastern religions, the whole Hinduism, stressing the whole, Buddhism, stressing mindfulness, and Taoism, stressing spontaneity. Well, what about the three Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam? Well, it seems to me that Judaism celebrates uprightness. Uprightness. And it celebrated that very early, indeed. Long before the Buddha, the Jewish inspiration was a peculiar kind of uprightness, righteousness, which the ancient world needed like mad, not to mention the modern world. Following Judaism, an offshoot of Judaism, Christianity, I think we have very little difficulty in characterizing Christianity as the genius of Christianity. It is self-giving love. Self-giving love. And Islam, a second offshoot from Judaism, submission, surrender. Now it seems to me that each of those religions, particularly the five, leaving out Taoism, each of those five contains all of them. Buddhism has all those elements. But they're harder to find, perhaps, harder to find each of those than it is with this particular characteristic which is so prominent, namely mindfulness. And equally, it seems to me, Christianity has all these, certainly Hinduism, we can find all these again. So each of these religions has a genius, and the genius of Buddhism is mindfulness, attention, telling it like it is, or humility before the fact. Humility before the fact. Which seems to me to be what science is about, or should be about, pure science. Humility before the fact. Now that is so different from what has been advertised to be religion down the ages. You will find it, as I said, in all the great religions, but my gosh, it is difficult to find with anything like this power and this stress, this emphasis in the other religions, this respect for what is given, telling it like it is, noticing what's so. And it is that which makes Buddhism, to me, a uniquely precious religion, uniquely precious. And in my life it has therefore played a very great part. And now may I just be very briefly autobiographical and explain why and how Buddhism came, so to speak, to my rescue when I needed this encouragement in what I perceived to be humility before the fact, as I saw the fact of my life. I won't go into all my problems as a young man, because that would be an endless recital, very boring and very difficult to encompass them all. I had every problem you could imagine. But I had one thing which was not a problem, which was a grace or a benefit, and something that took me to Buddhism, and that was curiosity. Curiosity. It was during the war, and I was in the Far East, and things looked pretty dicey. I was not at all sure whether I was going to survive. And it seemed to me crazy treat me stupid, chicken-hearted, evil-minded. Not to have a look at who this chap was. Fancy living and dying without ever looking to see who's doing so. In my own way, for myself, not taking anyone else's word for it. So there in India, I resolved to inquire what I was, to be attentive, to be mindful, and mindful not about this direction only, not about what this experience out there, not about the world, not about my environment only, off I know, but about what's in this direction, not merely about what I'm looking at, but what I'm looking out of. Now, Buddhism seemed exactly what I needed. But I didn't know anything about Buddhism at that time, or very little. And what I knew was not this kind of attention this way. So I was on my own in this endeavor. I needn't have been, but I happened to be on my own in this endeavor and in this discovery. And I made a very, very simple and obvious discovery about myself. Which I will share with you now, without any difficulty whatever. If you are interested to share it with me, it's so obvious. I almost blush. It's so obvious. But so important. You see, I was determined. While I was still around, to have a look at who this chap was that was still around, for himself. What was I like for myself? What was I looking out for? Well, it would help if you would just make a little effort to share this with me, because it's so simple. And it would help perhaps if you would look perhaps at Johnny or at me, I don't even know the daffodils, you know, it'd be nice if you just looked in this direction and took in the scene here and just have a look at what's taking in the scene where you are. What are you looking out of in your own experience at this time? And I'm asking you to do this, because it's so easy and so simple and so obvious and so necessary and so profound, and should lead us and does lead us and will lead us to the very heart and soul of what for me is the essence of Buddhism. Well, in your own experience, please, what are you looking out of? I mean, just for a start, are you looking out of two apertures? Two. Is it? Are you looking through two little holes? Yeah. Two peepholes. Or is it just one? And is this one great window where you are without any edges? John, if I hit you, you'll have to forgive me. Okay. I'm apt to do this, you know, I'm waving my arms like this. See, look, you can see what you're looking at. John, Mr. Snelling, John Snelling, and some daffodils, and Douglas here, etc. You're looking at this scene here, and plus a couple of windows. That's what you're taking in. But what's taking it in your own experience now, when you stop thinking and do a bit of mindfulness, which is what Buddhism is all about, to be attentive to what is attending. If anyone is attending, if there is someone there attending, or whether it's just the scene. All right, I can tell you what it's like for me at this time. And will you check and see whether I'm different from you, or whether you're in the same strange condition? Well, I mean, I see this room here, and all of you, all your faces, and the walls, and the table. It all comes of it. Here, I see this rather nice, don't you think, rather nice. I think I must have put it on for some reason, rather to emphasize something, see? Emphasize something. And the whole darn thing stops here. You see, I see the ceiling and the window and your faces and this thing and this tablecloth, etc. And this tie. It all stops here. And I have all you mounted on my shoulders at this moment, so to say. And there's absolutely nothing here at all, but nothing, in my experience. And I'm not looking at you through two holes in a meatball, I promise you. I'm not. It's just absolutely clear here. Well, you're the authority on what it's like where you are. Are you stuck in a box there? Are you small? Are you solid? Are you a thing? Very basic question. You look like at 10 feet, I promise you. You look as though you've got boundaries. You look like an object. You look like a thing. With great respect, even affection, I say you look like to me like you know, something with edges. I can draw you. I can draw you, and I can put a firm line around you. But I'm saying, are you like that where you are? Because you can't be like that. You can't, what I see you to be, you can't be like where you are. You've got to be different, haven't you? Because when you go up to things, they look different, don't they? John, when you go up to things, they look different. Yes. They must look different. I mean, I go up to that picture. It's a picture, I mean, that tapestry, isn't it? Tapestry on the painting. I go up to it, I see the whole painting. I go up to it with my camera, I go up to it, and I get a little hungry ghost. Or David or something, get a hungry ghost. And I go a little nearer and I get the head of a hungry ghost. Yeah, I really go up. And then I go nearer still, I get the eye of a hungry ghost. And I go right up to it and I don't get a hungry ghost at all. I get nothing at all. Because I'm bang up against it. Well, you're bang up against yourself. And, you know, if I come up... Look, if I would go up to John now, which I'm not going to embarrass him by then. But John, look, if I go really up to you, using my, you know, instruments that I have in there, microscopes, if possible, even electron microscopes, you know, I really do. I promise you. I promise you, John, whatever I go up to, I lose. And I've gone up to Douglas, you see. I went up to Douglas long ago, and I lost him. And I never had him here. I have him in the mirror, but I'm talking about face now. And I have it here. I have lots of stuff down here, which is interesting to have, but I don't have anything here. Now, I'm going on about this because I necessary to share with you this simple thing. And you will see why in India some 40 years ago. When I talk to people about this, I wasn't perhaps quite as expert at talking about it as I am now, but people thought I was crazy a bit. People thought I was a bit dotty. Harmlessly so. And, well, fairly harmlessly so. And it's really true. I mean, I promise you, I went round talking like this. I said, I haven't got a head, you see. Instead of a head, I've got the Himalayas, or, you know, all the heads in the world except the one that I put here. The other people say it's here, and they're right about it from their point of view. The only head I never had on my shoulders was Douglas's. The only head I never had on my shoulders was Douglas's, unless you count Douglas's in the mirror. I've got that one, of course. Well, I talked to people about this and tried to share it with them for something like 15 years. And you know, some people thought I was very, very deep and clever and mystical and strange and splendid. Very few people thought that. Very, very few. Most people thought that I was just stopping. But as I say, in a kind of harmless way, I was mad in a certain department. I wasn't mad all over. I was just mad in a region. In this region, you see. And, the first person I shared it with, I think it was 18 years after I had it. And around that time, I thought, I can die now. I shared it with someone. But around that time, it happened that I started reading Zen Buddhism. And I found that although I could explain this to nobody, I did have some friends. And those friends were the early Zen masters. Now, let me just tell you quickly the sort of thing that encouragement I found. And this is what's so special about Buddhism for me. I found, for example, the story of Tungshan. Now, Tungshan was the founder of Soto Zen. And Soto Zen is the biggest school of Zen in Japan today. So, very prestigious gentleman, Tungshan. 9th century Chinese. And the story goes that he was a boy. Incidentally, it's very interesting that these chaps tended to be boys. Huinong was a boy, and he was the virtual founder of the Zen itself. He was a boy when he happened to notice that his original face, see what his original face was like, his face that was no face, but the voice. He was a boy when he found out. He hadn't been sickly at all with a pale cast of thought. Buddhist thought, particularly. But Tungshan's a bit later than Huinong, and he was a boy, as I said, and he was studying under a Vinaya master in China, and he happened to be reading the Heart Sutra. Now, the Heart Sutra is mercifully short, unlike most of the other sutras, it's mercifully short, and my version of it is even shorter. Because I'm going to leave out a lot of the, dare I say, padding. And it runs like this. This sutra that he was reading. Hear, O Shariputra, form is void, but the void also is form. Hear, no eye, no nose, no lips, no mouth, no ears, etc. Nor the functions of those organs. Da 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 da. Therefore the bodhisattva ceases to tremble for what can go wrong. And then it says, wow. In Sanskrit. Well, Tungshan was reading this. And he was puzzled, naturally. Because he looked at his master, and had gone with like, he looked at his master and said, Master, you've got these things, as I see, perceived there, and I got them, and he did this. And the Buddha says, we haven't got them. This Heart Sutra, which is the principal sutra of Mahayana Buddhism. Buddha says, we don't have these things. Here are no eyes, no nose, no mouth, etc. The Buddha wouldn't tell a lie. He couldn't understand it. So the master said, well, you better go and study under a Zen master because I don't know the answer. So he went and studied under a Zen master, or Zen master, studied under all sorts of masters. And he grew up without ever finding the answer. And then, one day, He was crossing over a sort of pond on a plank, I guess, or a bridge. Very smooth water. And he looked down and he saw his face in the water. And in Suzuki's Essays in Zen, Volume 2, I think it is, you will see a picture there
of Tung Shan, now grown up, looking down at his face in the water. Where he kept, where he keeps it. That's where he keeps it. And that was the moment of his, dare I say, the word which I blush to mention, that was his enlightenment. In other words, he saw the obvious. He detected the obvious. And he saw where he kept those things that the Buddha was talking about, eyes and nose and all that stuff. Now, of course I've got an eyes and nose and all that stuff. They're your problem. Douglas's face, it's your problem, Marion. If John were a magician had turned my beard bright blue, that'd be your problem. I wouldn't know, would I? I wouldn't know. So my face is your problem. And my face is there. You have it where you are. It's there. It's not here. And if you don't believe me, come and see. You know, anyone is invited. Come up and have a look. Or after, perhaps not, so we don't say, you've got too long, so afterwards you can come and see. And you come up to me and you will lose Douglas's face, because you've got it where you are, and I ain't got it here. Because I don't keep it here, I keep it about 6 feet away. I keep it in the mirror. And this isn't peculiar to faces, you see. This is something perfectly ordinary. You could call it a philosophical point. Look, where are the daffodils? The daffodils are in me and in John and in you. These daffodils are in you. They really are in you. Like the star is in you that you see. And every astronomer knows that the star he photographs and has in his observatory is a star in the observatory. The darn thing probably blew up a million years ago, or if it's a galaxy. What you see here. What I see here. And I see you. And I see the daffodils. I go up to the daffodils, and I don't find the daffodils. I go up to daffodils, and I get a flower, and then I get a petal, and then I get a cell, or several cells, and I get molecules and atoms and particles, until at the point is there, no daffodil. So the daffodils are in us. See, we made a mistake about where things are. And now you have to be a little bit intelligent to get this one. It's a strange thing. Normally, I would say all we need to be is just stupid to get the truth. Or just fools, really. Or just childish. Childlike. But there's this thing that does require just a little bit of intelligence. And you're all so intelligent. I know you are. And you can all see that what you see where you are. Where you hold your camera. Look, if you want to photograph me, you hold the camera there. You don't hold it here. You don't hold it here. You hold it there. Because the camera can't pick up what's elsewhere. It can only pick up what's where it is. What is where the camera is. Can't it? And you can only pick up what is where you are. And I would suggest to you that where you are in your own experience, is if you check, I'm not telling you, I'm suggesting that where you are no thing. Absolutely nothing whatever. And therefore you're full of the whole darn world. I know it's a little bit of the world now, but you can go out and have London in it, and you look up the heavens and get a thousand stars in it. What you have there, I suggest, sitting on your chair, is a wonderful nothingness full of the whole darn world. And this is what the mystics of all those great religions say. St. John of the Cross, to be all things and to be nothing. Buddhism goes on and on about this. Form is void, but the void also is form. Where you are is void, isn't it? But the void is full of form. Look, you've got an option here. Either you're a little bit of this darn world, you're a little thing in the world, or your capacity for the whole world. Now, what have we got against ourselves? You know? I mean, what bad business it is to trade one's initial space, one's first personhood that one had as a little child. Because we were all born space for the world to happen in, weren't we? Every kid, indeed every adult, and sometimes kids will tell you this. In fact, kids have told me this. Douglas, I'm space for the world to happen in. Now, to cheat ourselves, because we've stopped being space for the world to happen, and we've become one of the things in the world. We become a thing in the world. In other words, we trade our central reality for our regional theorem. I'll say that again. We trade our original native reality, which is this wonderful aware void nothingness. We trade that for one of the items in that original void nothingness. In other words, we say, I am what I look like to other people, but I'm not what I look like to myself. To be born as capacity to the world and to finish as one of the little tiny things in that capacity. That's not growing up, that's growing down. That's not growing up. No, we have a very fine English mystic called a marvelous story called Thomas Graham, whom I recommend to you with all my heart. Let you know him, I don't doubt. He said, no brim nor border, in myself I see, my essence is the past. So special about this. See, what I've been talking about, I have been to a lot of trouble to find in all the great religion dimensions. And I can, and have, and my friends have packed down this experience in Hinduism, in Taoism, even in Judaism. Some rude way to put it, but never mind, it's not meant to be rude. In Christianity and in Islam, I would say particularly in Islam, Rumi is full of it. The greatest mystical poet in the whole world, perhaps, Rumi is full of it. This is found in all these great religions, but in Buddhism it seems to me to be there insisted upon. Insisted upon. Well, how is it we miss it? How is it that those of us who are Buddhists put the thing, you know, right at the end of several lifetimes, at the end of this lifetime, I think that's what they see. How much sitting meditation have you done? I mean, and how many lifetimes have you been doing this? Well, for all you know, chum, I've been doing it for a million lifetimes. For all you know, and for all I know. So I'm going to give myself the benefit of the doubt, you see, and say, well, who knows? If you say, well, Doug, if you think you're enlightened because you haven't put in the work, I say, I don't know. And the only way you can find out whether you put in the work is to look and see if you can see who you are now. And if you can see who you are now, you must have put in the work. Well, I mean, isn't that chance? Isn't that reasonable? And I know I'm seeming a bit frivolous here. I'm not really being frivolous. I'm really being extremely sincere here. I hope not solemn, because you see, I think spirituality, to get solemn, has really got nasty. And it seems to me this is really hilarious. Really hilarious. Well, what's so special about Buddhism seems to me to be the fact that it talks about attention. Now, attention or mindfulness is twofold. And for most of us, most of the time, and that's quite proper, I suppose, the mindfulness is, the arrow of mindfulness is outward. The breathing, you know, these various meditations, the breathing, walking, thinking, the thoughts, the
feelings that come up, all his attention is directed at objects of some one kind or another. This way. But I think it is Satipatthana Sutta. Is that right?
It says that the only purpose of this outward going mindfulness is eventually, and sooner rather than later, hopefully, to turn the arrow of attention round and attend to the offender, if any. Attend to the offender as himself. And so, the true Buddhist mindfulness, as I read the Buddhist scripture, is a double arrow pointing that way and this way.
And that's what I invited you to do just now. Look at us on the platform and the daffodils, what you're at, but also look what you're looking out at. That two-way attempt.
And I think you'll see, looking at me,
if you look at my face now,
please look at my face.
Now, is there anything that you're in to match it? Is it a symmetrical situation? Look, John and I are face-to-face, aren't we?
For you,
we are face-to-face. But John, are we face-to-face?
And your face.
You've got my face.
Now, I would really suggest, John, at least what my experience is, that we're trading beers.
Yes?
Yeah.
It's nice. It's just courteous, loving, beautiful thing to do.
Yes, it
really is. I mean, isn't it creepy?
Absolutely.
And isn't it mindfulness that sets us up? You're mindful of what you're looking at, John, and you're mindful of what you're looking at out of this situation. And it's a double arrow of mindfulness. It seems to me Buddhism is about that.
Oh, but I can hear somebody say, you know, you could quote dozens and scores of scriptures of me and suggest that this has got to be shallow because it's easy. Well, in my book and in my experience, easy does not necessarily mean shallow. In other words, I think in my experience, the universe is not that kind of universe. The universe, on the contrary, is a kind of hearted universe which makes the truth available not for just a simple good people, not for evil, not even for people who clocked up X hours or years or life. Sitting meditation. The universe has made the essential truth available to those who can just relax into a kind of simplicity. Drop ideas, drop ideas, drop it, and just have to look at life. It's accessible. And it's from the Pali Canon. Pali Canon. What are these crazy inventions? From the Pali Canon.
And it's page 64 of the Wisdom of Buddhism by none other than the president of this society. He quotes from the Pali. This is the peace. It is the highest, namely the cessation of all existence, the freeing of oneself from every form of becoming, the annihilation of craving, the turning away from desire, even cessation, even nirvana. Nirvana is visible in this life. Inviting. Accessible to the wise disciple. And if you like something from the Mahayana, or Zen, Let me quote Ubon, a distinguished Japanese master, medieval, I guess. He said, Zen puts enlightenment first. Oh. To get rid of your bad karma, would it be one day, and well, let that down, with a view to enlightenment one day? The only thing is, it isn't very practical. Best thing to do is to see who you are and get rid of your bad karma after. And it's best thing to do is to free translation, at least to a certain extent. It's essential. I know no distortion, serious distortion here. It says, get your enlightenment first and get rid of your bad karma after. You don't know what you're up to. And at this point, and I really mean, I must say this with all my heart. This is the easiest thing in the world to see that you are safe. Worry, nothing to the world happening. And all you've got to do is look at what you're looking at. Look there, that's all. It's the easiest thing in the world. Say this much advertised enlightenment sense is the easiest thing in the world. It's not to make it. You can advertise to be the most important, that's easy. Well, how come the difficulty is? Well, the difficulty is there. And it's also the most difficult thing in this case. I didn't say most of it, but certainly one of the things in the world. It's also, in my experience, immensely difficult, but immensely rewarding, to keep the dancing up. See, I mean, to see it is easy. Now, it takes everything. It takes your guts, your life, your blood, your spirit, everything. It takes everything you've got to bring it to maturity by doing it, by doing it. You don't do it wrong from the start. You can't do it wrong. But you can't do it wrong. What I'm talking about, you can't do it wrong. You can't get a kind of shadow or something here, can you, John? It's just gone, or it's either there, it's not. You are the void. You're no kind of half of void, are you? Or a spotty void. You're the void, and the void is void is void. Now, the difficulty comes in, and it is not only a difficulty, it's an immense privilege, and it is a joy, and it's a great lift. And I think living without it is more than it. But certainly the difficulty is in keeping up with the spirit. That's the thing. I have been failed miserably in keeping up. But I do find that life is the guru. And life gives me such a hell of a time. Such a hell of a time when I put the meatball back here. It's terrible. I just promise you it's terrible. To live from them being a saint. It's terrible. And I think my friend, his appearance here, horrible judge. It takes one hell of a lot of time. That's what it's doing now. But that's the thing. It's simple. Telling you what it is. And being mindful, not only what you experience. Not only the experience, but the experience. What is the experience of? What you're looking out at. Now, John, we're going to have some questions. If you'd like to have them for the last quarter of an hour, or would you like me to go on and have the questions after that? I think it would be very nice to have some questions at this stage, because be as severe with me as you can, I mean, if you wish. And these questions will bring out, and there are many, many things to be said. Many, many things to be said. And I think these questions will bring out what needs to be said far better than you can. So may I please have your objections, your thoughts, your contributions and we'll see what happens. Well, I think this is a very good question. I am not sure about this, but I am unrepentant. I'll tell you why. You see, it seems to me that you and I have all been hypnotized by language which says we're face to face. I mean, the hypnosis is so immense from early times to become what you look like. First of all, you're what you are, as a kid, as a baby. And then you gradually take on the game, the pretend, the laugh, which you are, really, what you look like to other people. And this is reinforced by language, the whole society, everything is feeding back to you. That you are there, that you look like. Now, when I got the only speakers in now to go and convey this to you, I'm apologetic for doing a bit of counter hypnotism. And I have experienced for 40 years here. And I don't think of a damn how I do it, so long as I can do it. And the resistance, now that the resistance, well, the resistance is enormous in all of us. That is enormous. And that people will find, and I think of your finding particular reasons, but I would suggest that you look at it. And what do you see out of this? Look at it and really face the question of resistance. Because it seems to me that we need the truth, something in which is desperate, but something in which resists. With equal desperation. And why do we resist it? It seems to me that it's a fundamental terror, is the terror of disappearance. And in the Diamond Seeker, you will find the author of the Diamond Seeker, that other great Mahayana teacher, says if you can see into your void nature, you're absolutely nothing with it, and that there is so good, you're quite funny. You know, and we are quite different. You know, I've had people attack me physically. I've had people go green, put their head between their legs. And it's, you know, to get their kind of circulation. It really is feminine. And there is a huge thing. But as far as I'm concerned, I think that what really matters is do I have a respect for you? I mean, I'm really appealing to your experience. And then I talk about my experience. It was all about that you may take out to your experience. I would say that this is absolutely a no-go trip unless you're taking out. The whole basis of my presentation this evening is that you should not believe. I mean, I swear to you, I mean, all concerned, that it would be a dead, absolutely dead loss if anybody here believes it. Without certainty, complete dead loss. And so you have to forgive the presentation. I can promise you that it is true. But I think lurking there is some very big questions. The radio station in common name says, just like you, let me mention other things. It happens that the early Zen master is comes down here in the 23rd and he employs vision more than other senses. On the other hand, you have the Tirangana system, where the Bodhisattva stood up one after the other. Set up one after the other and say which tense state they came in by. And some one came in by hearing, if you remember, and one by seeing, and so forth. But the Surandama Sutra says that the gate to who you are is tense. Now, that is the experience of the Surandama Sutra, I respect to my faith. My own feeling, belief, is there are many gates. There are many gates that are almost as though I think. I can only think of a gate that is open to you. Now, we have
changes that are in us. Maybe they have time for us. The truth is the time for us. And again, we look, we close our eyes, and we go to bed, close our eyes, and see what we can find where we are. And I believe then, I suggest that we are open. That is what we find with our eyes open. No bounds, no shape, no colour, no form, just its expression, its capacity in which thoughts, feelings, sensations of warmth, so that's an experiment that we could spend half an hour doing. Now, about the intuition and all that other stuff, it seems to me that my spiritual life, if I may call it that, didn't work like that man, helped hopefully to run on three things, not one thing. And the one thing is the understanding. I say that I've spent a lot of my life trying to figure it out. It's a great job. And that's the kind of thinking that I understand. The perception, you know, the on about, no eyes, no nose, no, is this thing. The Sriranga Sutra is on about the sense. And this is, for me, is crucial because I happen to be that type. Olympic form is that type. I just not. Now, there is a third reason, and that's that belly. And this is perhaps where you're thinking of the thing. And for me, this is the most important of all. That's all. And this feeling that, you know, that there's nothing here, it seems to me it develops into it sinks into it. If I'm so the truth that there's nobody here, so sorry. Actually, nobody here, that's the catastrophe of the world. But something goes on here. Let me put it like this. A thing in the world has wants, desires, needs, craves. One of things here are craving. But space has no craving. Space wills what is. Space has no will, of course. But if you, to put it in a kind of funny way, when I see that I am capacity and space, I choose what is. Space chooses what is, like a mirror rejects space. Now that happens in doctrine, and it happens in Christian. And in Christian terms, it's thy will be done. In Buddhist terms, not in Buddhism, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, about desire. Well, obviously, about the end of desire. The thing I read from it is a peace, and it is a higher, namely the cessation of all of this. The freeing of oneself in every form of becoming and the annihilation of space. That kind of thing, I do not accept that. That is space is the capacity. It is work. Now that is work. The work of thinking down in the past. And so, you know, it's time and opportunity that's limited. But I can promise you that third retiring on this third thing is an exclusive. I think you put your finger on it, Paul. If there's someone here, if someone has got to be looked after, you've got to have desires and needs and all that kind of stuff. This one here is in relationship to the thing there. And that means it has great news today. Full of desire. Now, how is that? How does the Buddha suggest that can be got over? Well, my reading of the situation is this, that the world in my face, the things in my face, come out all short, yellow, green, nice, nasty, wicked, desirable, poisonous, delicious. All those things, and the qualities adhere to the object and don't stain or involve the subject here, because there is no substance of self. It doesn't mean that one is indifferent to the world. On the contrary, one is more sensitive to the world, perhaps, and more sensitive to nuance of things, not less. It is not a way of becoming unobservant or undiscriminate. And you say that Ethel M. Dell is as good as Shakespeare, I mean, everything. You know, or Picasso is no better than, you know, the and the corner drawing on the paper. And they're all the same. I mean, this is not it at all. It is the freedom. Freedom here from any kind of staining by the time. And it's a paradox. I think one thing we don't always realize, very hard to realize, is that in this realm we're talking about, the law, the Aristotelian law of contradiction, you know, is not being, so it doesn't hold. And you get another law going, another logic going, the logic of paradox, or the coincidence of opposite. So to be nothing, and to be all things. To be the cat, and to love the world, and to be the world. You see, the marvelous thing is, if I'm nothing, I am the world. If I'm Douglas, I'm in real trouble because I'm alienated from the world. If I'm nothing, I'm like a love affair. Of course. Yes. Yes. And also, Paul, I mean, you notice, I think, that the saints and sages that have really lived haven't been just sat on their bottom and done it. They've been some of the most active and influential people in the world. You know, the inside story was to complete the character, you know, but the outside story is totally different. It's a very, very good point. This is not a way of detaching yourself from the world, it's a way of being. It's a hard time. Because when you take on the world, that's one of the reasons why you're scared of this, I think. Because you're going to take on the suffering of the world. You're going to get hurt. Very badly hurt. And you're going to get all the joy that you imagine yourself. And you can't wash your hands of anyone or anything. Space can't wash it. Boy can't wash it. Got no hands to wash.
The training that Nirvana undergoes, it has two aspects. It is one is to bring about this experience of insight, and the other is to serve the mental strength to contain it.
And
what do you think is important to me is that I'm talking about the economy of the insight and not so much about that developing?
Yes, John, and I think I have, partly on account of the exigencies of time. I would say that there are many techniques, and probably all of them good. I mean, they're so different. We use some techniques to teach people a different customer, a different set, different religion, different techniques. And you can't say that one of those is right or well wrong. You can't, for instance, elevate Zazen to be the only way. And you rule out about three quarters of the saints and sages of the world. Yes, I would like to say something about that. I would say that for me, the primary factor of this insight, the deepening of this insight, is the practice of this insight. And, you know, it's like a television set. You see, I use this simile here in this room before, I'm sure.
There are several ways of getting your television set, your nice, cheaper, colourful television. One is to save up for it. And the only thing is, if you save up for it, it's getting more expensive. And the more you save, the more expensive it is. You delay getting this darn television set. So the other way is to take delivery now and pay on installment. And this being who you are, you can take delivery now. But you've got to pay, you've got to keep up installment, otherwise they come and collect. You see? So how do you keep up installment? And I think the way you keep up installment is to do the rules. Well, that's it.